WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Vicki Barker. The battle for the battleground states intensifies. Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump courting those swing voters. CBS's Natalie Brand reports.
Harris spent Friday in parts of the Keystone State that have voted for Trump as she tries to appeal to moderate Republicans. Next week, she will join Oprah Winfrey for an online event called Unite for America, part of Winfrey's effort to drive voter turnout. Former President Donald Trump rallied in Las Vegas Friday night.
I'm angry about rampant inflation destroying our middle class, and the American people are damn angry too. We're all angry.
Will President Biden allow Ukraine's President Zelensky to hit targets inside Russia with U.S.-made advanced weaponry? CBS's Weijia Jiang has that.
What Ukraine is pushing for is to be able to use long-range missiles. They've already been using these, but not directly into the heart of Russia. And Zelensky argues that he believes having the opportunity to do that could be a game changer with regard to winning this war. But of course, there are other calculations and reasons why there are regulations and rules on how to use U.S. supplied weapons.
No word on any decision reached. Boeing workers are spending a second day on the picket line. They say a 25% pay hike offer won't keep up with what they've already lost. The company says the walkout's hurting an already struggling business. CBS's Carter Evans reports.
We just want a fair share of the pot.
In the Seattle area, where the median cost for a home is more than $800,000, these union workers say Boeing just doesn't pay enough.
Some people in my shop have to, they work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, to make a living.
At a conference, Boeing Chief Financial Officer Brian West said the company is focused on restoring our trust with our people and the union, but added the strike will jeopardize our recovery.
In Cambridge, Massachusetts this
year. Just like the real Nobels.
This year's winners each get an Ig Nobel Prize.
What is it?
A piece of paper says they've won an Ig Nobel Prize.
The website Annals of Improbable Research wants to make people laugh and think with unusual winners in, say, rocket science.
Housing live pigeons inside missiles to guide the flight paths.
Botany.
Evidence that some real plants imitate the shapes of neighboring artificial plastic plants.
And of course, economics.
The fiscal stimulus won't cause inflation. Oops.
Michael Toscano, CBS News.
It's the science prize no scientist wants to win. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. You may have heard by now Wisconsin is a battleground state in the presidential campaign. That makes it especially important for Wisconsin voters to educate themselves. More from Mike Mohn.
University of Wisconsin-Green Bay political scientist David Helpap says if you're approached by a campaign volunteer, ask about the candidate's stances on certain issues. After that encounter, a little homework is encouraged.
If time allows it, do some of your own research to check the facts, to go to news sources, reputable news sources. There are some nonprofit organizations out there that try to provide good, nonpartisan, unbiased information.
Vote411.org is one of those sites that outline a candidate's stances on certain issues, as well as their previous voting and policy record. HelpApp says cross-checking that information with the answers from a campaign staffer can help assess whether that person is worthy of your vote. He also encourages comparing criticisms of rival candidates with the facts to see if they match up. HelpApp says if you have the time, attending a political rally is another valuable way of becoming an informed voter.
And particularly in swing states where we are seeing so many visits by different people, politicians, groups, even celebrities in some cases.
HelpApp says even if you don't agree with a candidate's views, showing up to an event allows you to gain some insight into how other voters feel, possibly making political discourse less hostile. He adds this kind of added exposure is hard to come by in non-swing states. Political experts say these tips are just as important in designing candidates for state and local offices. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 70s, southeast winds 5 to 10. For tonight, partly cloudy, a low of 67. 78, mostly sunny for your Sunday. Mostly sunny, 82 on Monday. Sunshine for Tuesday, with highs near 80.
It's 60 at our studios.
Dom Salvia.
Next time, join me as we start the new week barely towards the presidential election. We'll have a week full of special guests, celebrity hosts, and you. Tune in.
The Dom Salvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6. You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Jim Santel, and yes, this is Amicus, a law review, our weekly weekend review of all things court-related, justice-related, and matters related to the aspiration for justice in America, including lots of our operations of government, both local, state, and federal. Thank you once again for joining me on our weekend broadcast. This is Amicus, a law review. We take our name, as always, our adopted commission to conduct a review, an analysis, some deliberation, some consideration of the most recent news stories of our times in those areas that are important to our lives and our livelihood. Amicus, of course, coming from the Latin, it's also a legal term meaning friend, an individual, an organization that assists in understanding or appreciation, some assessment of some relevant issues or questions that need to be resolved, need to be addressed in some way, most typically by a court, but not always, sometimes by another entity, some private, some public entity that's got some responsibility for decision-making in our lives, and thus the name of our weekend weekly broadcast, Amicus, a Law Review, focusing once again on significant news items of the week, sometimes beyond, here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Delighted, as always, to have you be a part of our discussion. That can happen a couple of different ways. You can call in to me and to my superb producer, Max, and you can get to us at 844-967-2789. That telephone number, once again, 844-967-2789, or you can also drop a note into the Civic Media app and let us know about your question, your inquiry about anything on our ambitious but achievable agenda, our syllabus, our academic review this weekend in these areas. Be a part of our discussion. And again, delighted to have you with me, honored to have you a part of our presentation, our program here on Civic Media. Let's talk about what is on the syllabus for this weekend show. Again, lots and lots of things happening in the world of government and justice and law generally. We're going to spend the first hour talking about a number of different issues that have animated a lot of the news stories in this past week. We're going to begin by talking about the Violence Against Women Act, the 30th anniversary of VAWA just this past week. We're going to talk about some things that President Biden said, but also remember something that the Supreme Court did not recently, but a number of years ago to undermine, to stop some portions of VAWA as it was initially enacted. We'll think about that and talk about the consequences not only of VAWA, the very positive things that it has done in the context of an otherwise very challenging area, violence against women, and also expanded to include men legislatively and operationally. We're also going to chat about a somewhat related subject, and that is Merrick Garland, Attorney General, who is responsible in large part for administering, for executing the law, VAWA. Also spent some time this past week talking about the dangerous and outrageous attacks on the Department of Justice and prosecutors, investigators, personnel inside the government, the consequences of those, chastising those people who would make those attacks, those threats. We'll talk about what exactly he said, why those words from our chief federal law enforcement officer are so very, very important to understanding our lives. And then we're also going to talk about something else related to the Department of Justice, and that is its continuing prosecution. Yes, indeed, they continue to this day, and that is the prosecution of individuals, the identification, the investigation of people who were responsible for the attack on the Capitol on January 6th. We'll talk about one of the recently charged defendants. We are still identifying and charging them. A present Army soldier charged with involvement in the attack, the insurrection on January 6th. And then we'll talk about what the Department of Justice is doing in the wake of that major case issued by the Supreme Court, not the immunity case, but that Fisher matter that restricted the ways in which one of the particular statutes used by the government, by the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia, restricting the use of that and its impact upon some of the many, many hundreds of defendants who've now been charged, some subset of them affected in terms of the judgments, the jury verdicts, the findings previously entered against them. We'll talk about the consequences of the Supreme Court's decision in Fisher, F-I-S-C-H-E-R, on those various prosecutions. And then finally, in this first hour on Amicus, we're going to be talking about two matters involving Donald Trump. One of them related to the continuing prosecution, the litigation of cases in Georgia, in particular in Fulton County. The impact of what the presiding judge in Fulton County did this past week with respect to two of the many remaining counts in the indictment against Donald Trump and many others there alleging election interference. We'll talk about what Judge Scott McAfee did, his orders dismissing two more counts in that indictment. What are the consequences of that? What does that mean? How did he come to that result? And we'll also update you on the status generally of the appeal in that case related to whether the prosecutor, Fani Willis, can continue to prosecute the case as that matter moves forward, even without a set trial date, no date coming up in this calendar year. And then another case, completely unrelated, but for the fact that it involves a similar defendant or close defendant, his name once again, Donald Trump. I'm going to talk about what a Cook County judge in Northern Illinois did just this past week in connection with something called the Illinois Environmental Protection Act. What did that judge find with respect to Trump Tower in downtown Chicago? What did he find? What violations did he find that were being perpetrated by the leadership, the organization, the management of Trump Tower, this major building that has the former president's present candidate for the presidency, his name emblazoned boldly on the side of that building just along the Chicago River? A major decision by a Cook County judge in the environmental area finding environmental violations by the Trump Organization in its management and supervision of that particular building related to water and related to fish in that water. We'll talk about exactly what that means. A split count, if you will. This past week, Donald Trump successful in getting two additional counts dismissed in that criminal prosecution in Georgia, not successful in defending against an environmental claim in Chicago in Northern Illinois. We'll talk all about that. And then in our second major hour, two other significant stories, again, of this past week, but also of previous weeks. This past week, we saw the initiation, finally, of the trial of the police officers involved in the brutal beating of Tyree Nichols, this 29-year-old FedEx worker, January 2023, by Memphis police. The trial of those police for civil rights violations, criminal violations of the federal law began this past week at federal district court in Memphis. We'll remind you what Tyree Nichols' death was all about, why that happened, how that happened, and describe something of what we're already hearing inside the trial of that case, including some stunning revelations about some of the language used by police officers, including a run tax, a slogan, a linguistic flourish, if you will, a dark reference by law enforcement when it comes to the work that they are supposed to be doing on behalf of the constituencies of Memphis. We'll talk about why that phrase is significant in understanding, trying to understand what happened to Tyre Nichols, the death at the hands of police officers there in Memphis, most of them now on trial, some of them having pled guilty and testifying in that case in the weeks just ahead. We revisit what happened to Tyre Nichols and the present litigation, the criminal litigation against those people, those police officers who took his life back in January of 2023. And then we're going to return to an issue that we raised just at the end of our last broadcast last weekend. And that relates to the attempts by our federal government to address the involvement of Russia in the 2024 election. We have seen this story. We have witnessed this play once before, and it is back. Last week, we hinted at the story coming up in greater detail in the second hour of this broadcast related to what the United States Department of Justice is doing, including its prosecution of a couple of people responsible for attempting to undermine our 2024 campaign and the 2024 election results. Just this past week, in addition to that Department of Justice information, we also had the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, likewise talking about what the State Department, another agency of the federal government, what the State Department is doing in that same connection, responding with sanctions and other remedies to address what it has perceived as a very significant impact, a very significant threat posed by Russia, Russia entities, and Russia adjacent entities trying to counter the votes and the campaign progress with respect to all voting in America. We'll talk about what Antony Blinken said, complimenting being a part of this government-wide, this one government approach to addressing Russian interference in, yes, the 2024 election, the 2024 campaign now underway. Talking about all of that in the courts, out of the courts, all of that here on this weekend broadcast of Amicus, a law review, inviting you, as always, to join us for that discussion as we undertake it now in the moments and the hours just ahead. My name, Jim Santel, inviting your comments and inquiries at 844-967-2789. Also, asking for your insight, your perspectives, your questions, your inquiries about anything on our subject matter this weekend. Let's begin by talking about, yes, that's right, it's the 30th anniversary of the Violence Against Women Act. The 30th anniversary, 30 years ago, just this past week, this major, major legislation that changed the way in which the federal government, and yes, indeed, the state government, private entities, respond to the victim survivors of crime in America. It is a major, major piece of legislation, remains a significant tool in the toolbox of prosecutors and victim rights specialists, both inside the government and outside the government, when it comes to addressing the special needs and special interests, the special focus of victims across the panoply of crimes in America. The name of it has become a bit of a misnomer because while initially introduced and passed as the Violence Against Women Act, based upon an awful lot of present and past indication that women suffer inordinately from violence, also expanded to include men. And so virtually all of the aspects of the law now including across the board everyone who might be a victim survivor of crime in America. Also one of the major legislative pieces introduced by our current president, Joseph Biden, when he was in the United States Senate. As we continue our discussion, let's talk about VAWA, the 30th anniversary, and what the Supreme Court did way back a number of years ago in 2000 with respect to its important role in America as Amicus, a law review, continues.
You're listening to the Shaw WAUK, Waukesha's home for Up North News Radio.
Hey there, this is Carrie Joy with today's Work Money Minute, going out to anybody who wants to improve their money life, but maybe doesn't know where to start. Step one is just to look at your spending. That's it. Open up your credit card statement or your bank account and look at all the transactions and pay attention for just 5 minutes. Step two is to give yourself a minute to consider, does your spending reflect the life that you want to have? Is it getting you where you want to go? Which is why step three is really important. Be kind to yourself. Tell yourself that you can be good with money. The science is very clear about this, folks. Believing that you can is how you make change happen in your life. Today, I know I can be good with money. And that started with me telling myself I could be good with money. For more tips on how to save more and spend less, head on over to workmoney.org. In the meantime, this is Carrie Joy saying, take good care.
The Shaw, WAUK.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host this hour and next hour as well, as we talk about major stories in government and law, the aspiration for justice in America and beyond, beginning in this weekend broadcast, talking about VAWA, the Violence Against Women Act, recognizing just this past week the commemoration of 30 years since VAWA has been the law of our land. It is a piece of legislation that was introduced 30 years ago when Senator Joseph Biden was in the United States Congress. And this past week, President Joseph Biden commemorated and talked about the reasons why VAWA was important, remains hugely important to the administration of law in our nation, and also to protect and safeguard the rights and prerogatives and the positions of victims of crime. Recall well that VAWA, this Violence Against Women Act, saw the increase in justice generally for survivors of crime, accountability for the perpetrators, not just through criminal prosecution and sentencing, but also in other ways as well, created the first ever national hotline with respect to violence, specifically toward women, supported shelters and rape crisis centers, housing opportunities, legal assistance for women not previously available to them all across the country, districts in every part of our nation. Training for police officers and prosecutors and various private and public advocates, judges, court personnel, basically designed to make our justice system more fair, respond to the needs of victim survivors, again, women and men alike. Over time, the law has been expanded as the Congress has acted to recognize increased needs among victim survivors, expanded to increase access to sexual assault services, on places like college campuses, very important, invested in ending the backlog of rape kits, which we have seen in many states, including right here in Wisconsin over time, increasing protections for underserved communities of various natures. Hugely important in changing the ways in which U.S. attorneys and assistant U.S. attorneys and federal investigators, and most importantly, those people who support the victim survivors of crime, engage in that all important work, providing the tools, the mechanisms, and yes, indeed, the funding to make all of that happen. Congress passing that way back 30 years ago, just this past week. Significant on the 30th anniversary to remember what happened in 2000, the year 2000, again, 24 years ago, when the United States Supreme Court did something to carve away some of those features, at least one of them, that the Congress had passed. The justices split in a 5-4 vote in a case called United States versus Morrison. United States versus Morrison is the name of the case. It was authored by then Chief Justice William Rehnquist. He, of course, hails from Wisconsin. And at that time, in that Morrison case, the court had before it this question about the legitimacy of a particular provision of VAWA as it had been passed at that time. Specifically, the court approved striking down a provision of the law that let gender-based violence victims sue the perpetrators of that crime, those crimes, in federal court, giving them a private right of action, the opportunity to sue in civil court, not criminal court, on behalf of themselves and other people affected by that criminal activity. The only justice from that particular ruling who's still in the court today, Clarence Thomas, and he joined Rehnquist's majority opinion. In that opinion, Rehnquist, on behalf of the majority, again, 5-4, a split almost right down ideological lines, Rehnquist wrote that the Congress lacked the authority to enact the specific gender-based violence victim protection under VAWA. Part of the majority's decision or rationale for that conclusion was the Commerce Clause in the Constitution, of all things, And that, of course, gives Congress the authority to regulate interstate commerce, among other aspects of its authority. Gender-motivated crimes of violence are not, in any sense of the phrase, economic activity, the court wrote. That was the Chief Justice William Rehnquist striking down that portion of the law that gave victims, survivors of crime, the capacity to sue their perpetrators in federal court. Dissenting justices, and there were four of them, vigorous dissents, pointing out that the mountain of data assembled by Congress continues to be reviewed every single year, showing the effects of violence against women on interstate commerce. The majority writing that it rejected the argument that Congress may regulate non-economic violent criminal conduct based solely on that conduct's aggregate effect on interstate commerce. Now, that's a lot. That's a lot. Basically, what you have there is the dissenting justices saying, no, no, if you read the Commerce Clause broadly enough, as the courts have done in the past, you cannot only find a place for this provision inside the Commerce Clause, but it is comfortably right in that. Nonetheless, the rule in United States versus Morrison, the carve out for that particular provision, that affected way back in 2000 by the Supreme Court case, United States versus Morrison. Nonetheless, VAWA remains the law of the land in many, many other areas, continues to be invoked routinely, virtually every day in our nation by U.S. attorney's offices, by victim witness support units, by private sectors, public sectors, in this all-important attempt to address the special needs and interests and prerogatives and positions of victims nationwide. We recognize just this past week the 30-year anniversary of the Violence Against Women Act in all of its iterations, all of that happening just this past week. We also know coming out of the U.S. Department of Justice just this past week, another major event, Merrick Garland, whose staff, through the Assistant Attorneys General, through the Associate Attorney General, through U.S. attorneys, 92 of them nationwide, responsible for invoking and applying VAWA. This past week, Attorney General Merrick Garland addressing staff of the Department of Justice nationwide and denouncing what he called dangerous and outrageous attacks on Department of Justice prosecutors and personnel. He said in particular, in a speech that was sometimes emotional, very forceful, and he appeared to allude to all kinds of accusations and threats made unmistakably by President Donald Trump, even though not naming him by name in his speech. Of course, Donald Trump presently campaigning to return to the presidency, Garland not explicitly naming him, but nonetheless thanking the Department of Justice workers for their dedication in the face of what the Attorney General said was an escalation of attacks on the Justice Department's career lawyers and agents and other personnel over the last 3.5 years, noting this jump in these dangerous and outrageous attacks on the prosecutors and other personnel responsible for the administration of justice. Those attacks, he said, have come in the form of conspiracy theories, dangerous falsehoods, efforts to bully and intimidate public servants by repeatedly and publicly singling them out, threats of actual violence. It is dangerous, he said. It's outrageous that you have to endure them. And again, he's speaking directly to members of the Department of Justice staff. It's dangerous to target and intimidate individual employees of this department simply for doing their jobs. And it is outrageous, he said, that you have to face these unfounded attacks because you are doing what is right and upholding the rule of law. Receiving heavy applause when he said the way you do that work makes clear that the public servants of the Department of Justice do not bend to politics and that they will not break under pressure. Again, not specifically invoking Donald Trump, but unmistakably making reference to threats that he has advanced along with other conspiracy theories. More on this and other aspects of the rule of law when Amicus, a law review, continues on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for the Todd Allball Show.
CBS News Brief. Vice President Kamala Harris campaigning hard in swing state Pennsylvania. CBS's Natalie Brand reports.
Harris spent Friday in parts of the Keystone State that have voted for Trump as she tries to appeal to moderate Republicans. Former President Donald Trump rallied in Las Vegas Friday night.
I'm angry about rampant inflation destroying our middle class and the American people.
Will President Biden allow Ukraine to hit targets inside Russia with U.S.-made long-range missiles? White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre saying
only. The president is committed to make sure that Ukraine has what it needs to defend itself against Russia's aggression.
And the Ig Nobel Prizes were out this week. That's right, the Ig Nobel Prizes.
The website Annals of Improbable Research wants to make people laugh and think with unusual winners in, say, rocket science.
Housing live pigeons inside missiles to guide the flight paths.
CBS's Michael Toscano reporting. CBS News Brief, I'm Vicki Barker.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Bucky gets Bama. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cusco with sports, filling in for Mike Clemens. The Wisconsin Badgers play Alabama today in college football. Head coach Luke Fickell said that they feel prepared for everything they will see today.
I feel good. I mean, to be honest, we did a lot of that in the spring. We did a lot of that in fall camp in particular, saying, okay, we want offensively to take shots. We're going to script some of these things and make sure our guys are being challenged in ways. But, you know, it's harder when all of a sudden Saturdays come.
Kickoff is at 11 a.m. in Madison. The Brewers got a two-run home run from Reese Hoskins and beat Arizona 2-1 on Friday night. The win, coupled with losses by all of the teams below them in the standings, moved Milwaukee's magic number down to 5. Same two teams, Brewers and Diamondbacks, tonight. Green Bay quarterback Jordan Love is listed as questionable for tomorrow's game with an MCL sprain. Malik Willis is expected to be the starter when the Packers take on the Colts on Sunday. Both teams are looking for their first win. Kickoff is at noon. Filling in for Mike Clemens, I'm Jimmy Cusco with Civic Media Sports.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 70s, southeast winds 5 to 10. For tonight, partly cloudy, a low of 67. 78, mostly sunny for your Sunday. Mostly sunny, 82 on Monday. Sunshine for Tuesday with highs near 80.
It's 60 at our studios.
Some big ideas being shared at the Cap Times Idea Fest in Madison. Civic Media is proud to be a part of it and will broadcast the live one-on-one discussion with Nancy Pelosi. Hear what the first female Speaker of the House thinks about the state of politics and the presidential election, Monday, September 16th at 7:30 p.m. Live coverage of Nancy Pelosi from Idea Fest, Monday night, September 16th at 7:30 on your local Civic Media radio station.
Stream the best of British TV on BritBox. Watch captivating dramas and gripping mysteries, whether it's entire series of massive hits like Sherlock and Vera, new seasons of originals like The Responder, starring international Emmy winner Martin Freeman, or an extraordinary selection of beloved treasures featuring Idris Elba, Jodie Comer, Matthew McFadyen, Benedict Cumberbatch, and more. Only on BritBox. Watch with a free trial at BritBox.com.
There are so many traditions built around the Wisconsin Badgers, game day and the mascot, which in 1889 was a real badger. It didn't go well. Eventually, the animal was replaced by a person. An on-campus contest chose the official mascot name, Buckingham U. Badger. Still, Wisconsin's official animal is a badger. But do you know which animal almost earned this title instead? Gray squirrel? White-tailed deer? Black bear? The answer is coming up. The original badger's nickname is actually associated with lead miners in the state, not the animals. It was the 1820s, and the miners often didn't have shelter in the winters, so they lived like badgers, digging tunnels into the hillsides where they worked. So was there almost another state animal? Yes, the white-tailed deer, which later became the official wildlife animal. But the history surrounding the badgers is a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Andra Watkins returns. She grew up in a Christian nationalist household and can tell us how that relates to Project 2025. It's not good. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host this hour and next hour as well, as we talk about things in the areas of justice, government, and law. Thank you for joining me on our weekend broadcast here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, talking about this major address given by the Attorney General of the United States, his name Merrick Garland, to staff personnel of the Department of Justice, but really intended for all of us in America, 340 million people, talking about the danger that is being presented by these continuing threats, these conspiracy theories, falsehoods, efforts to bully and intimidate public officials, including those of the Department of Justice, in doing their jobs. Main thrust of the Attorney General's remarks just this past week is that every American equal under the law. Also, unmistakably, a message to Donald Trump. He says this, that is the Attorney General, there is not one rule for friends and another for foes, one rule for the powerful and another for the powerless, one rule for the rich and another for the poor, one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans, or different rules depending on one's race or ethnicity. All of that coming from the voice of the Attorney General. To the contrary, he said, we have only one rule. We follow the facts and we apply the law in a way that respects the Constitution and protects civil liberties. He said that he and other department officials, there are many of them there at Maine Justice throughout the country as well, will be fiercely protecting the Department of Justice's independence from what he called political interference in our criminal investigations. He says, we'll not allow the department to be used as a political weapon. We'll not allow law enforcement to be treated as an apparatus of politics. Describe some of the steps the department has already taken to protect the criminal and civil decisions of the department, like reinstating policies regulating communication between department employees and Congress and the White House, again, to stop any politicization of communications there. Other actions he described, including improving clarifying guidelines for sensitive FBI investigations, publishing new policies to guide prosecutorial discretion with respect to charging, pleas, and sentencing, all of that once again to promote the legitimacy, the ethical approach to investigation and prosecution by your Department of Justice. And then went on to talk about the attacks on prosecutors. He said this, you deserve better. You deserve gratitude for the noble and difficult work you do. You deserve recognition for the integrity and skill with which you do that work. You also have my promise, he said, that nothing will ever stop me from defending this department and the extraordinary people who work here. Since leaving office in 2021, Donald Trump has repeatedly lashed out at the Department of Justice and its investigators, unmistakably the focus of the Attorney General's words just this past week. While the Trump campaign did not specifically respond to what the Attorney General has said, there's no doubt that the former president and campaigner for the presidency has called DOJ employees derogatory names. He's called Special Counsel Jack Smith, who has charged Donald Trump in two separate cases through the grand jury process, called him deranged. He also has threatened prosecutors, saying in a Truth Social post, you may recall well, and part of this alluding to the 2020 election interference charges against him, he said, if you go after me, I'm coming after you. And beyond that, he has targeted other members of the Department of Justice as they have attempted to do their jobs in all of this undertaking. During the course of that six-week trial in which the defendant, Donald Trump, was ultimately found guilty of 34 violations of New York law, recall well that almost on a nearly basis, he was attacking the Biden Justice Department, being weaponized against him. He said that the Biden administration, through the Department of Justice, through Merrick Garland, had brought this case, when in fact, that's nothing could be further from the truth. It was brought by a state prosecutor, his name Alvin Bragg. Again, just this past week, the Attorney General pushing back on these attempts to intimidate and to threaten the Department of Justice and saying he will do all he can do to push back on all of that and ensure the legitimacy of prosecutions, investigations based upon the law and the facts and not being in any way affected by the political attacks that unmistakably have been a part of Donald Trump's statements publicly in America. This past week also saw some significant movement in connection with the continuing prosecutions of individuals responsible for the attack on the Capitol on January 6th. Two significant things of note just this past week. Biden administration, again, through the Department of Justice, announced some interesting results of this major decision of the Supreme Court in that Fisher case. The Fisher case, you may recall well, describing this notion, providing a broad interpretation, the notion of a statute that imposes up to 20 years in prison for those who corruptly obstruct, influence, or impede any official proceeding. And that particular statute, 18 U.S.C. 1512, invoked with respect to the prosecutions of many people, including a fellow named Fisher, who said that that particular statute cannot apply to him because he wasn't involved in any documents. He wasn't involved in any papers, any physical materials. And in Fisher versus the United States, the Supreme Court agreed with him and said you can't use that simply for broad obstructive acts. You've got to identify some specific documents, some papers, some materials that were impeded or they were affected in some way as a result of the conduct of the defendant. And since the ruling in Fisher then, the Department of Justice has gone back and looked at those, more than a handful, but a number of defendants who were charged and convicted under Section 1512. 60 out of 126 defendants have had their pending obstruction charges dismissed as a result of the decision by the United States in that Fisher case, according to information just released recently by the U.S. Department of Justice. Of the 133 defendants whose cases were already resolved before that Fisher decision, before the Supreme Court limited the application of the statute, the department indicated that it does not oppose dismissal or vacatur, which is basically removing the effect of the judgment, of the charge in approximately 40 cases, and continues to assess the rest. And basically, in a number of cases, said we're not going to drop prosecutions. In other cases where we can, in fact, meet what the Supreme Court has said, we can, in fact, show the defendants engaged in conduct that involved papers and documents and movement of those kinds of things as a part of the overall charge to obstruct or influence or impede an official proceeding. Of course, that official proceeding was the counting of electoral votes on January 6th in the wake of the election of 2020. The Department of Justice, accordingly to reporting, is still pursuing obstruction charges for 13 defendants and evaluating some of its next steps for remaining cases. Among those, for example, prosecutors have said that defendants Don and Shaundell Chilcote, in a case involving them, that there is sufficient evidence to suggest that those two siblings, brother and sister from Ohio, understood that their trek into the Senate floor would, in fact, block Congress from meeting. And under the circumstances of what they did, the prosecution of them under the Fisher statute under 1512 would continue. And so even as the Department of Justice appropriately following what the Supreme Court has said, even while that continues to happen, the reality is that the Department of Justice is dismissing some, not a huge number, but some of those cases pending there in the federal district court, vacating some of the judgments and declining to prosecute further some of those cases that otherwise would have brought many, many defendants charged both under Section 1512 and other statutes. Those continue, including Mr. Fisher himself. Six other counts beyond the Fisher statute. Mr. Fisher also still facing imposition and sentencing for those as well. So all of that coming out of the U.S. Department of Justice just this past week. In connection with that, the Department of Justice continues, as I said, to identify and prosecute people who are responsible for engaging in this kind of behavior. And another one of just this past week, among the hundreds of people, well over 1,000 now, who've been prosecuted in the wake of the January 6th riot. Let's talk about U.S. Army soldier Alexander Poplin. He was arrested this past week in the barracks, the Schofield Barracks. It was an Army installation near Honolulu. Poplin, who is 31 years old, he comes from Hawaii, scheduled to make his initial appearance in federal court just this past week, arrested on charges that he repeatedly struck a police officer with a flagpole during his attack and the attack of the mob, the rioters, on January 6th, more than 3 years ago. And that, according to the court records, of course, all of the information provided in the public domain just this past week. The FBI apparently identified him this way, as is often the case. They received a tip in February of 2021 that Poplin, again, this military individual, had posted on Facebook about attacking police during the Capitol riot. He wrote on Facebook that we took our house back and we stood for something. That's what he wrote. July of 2024, an FBI investigator interviewed Poplin's military supervisor, who identified Poplin in a photograph showing him wearing an army camouflage backpack inside the restricted area of the Capitol. Yes, on January 6th of 2021. All of that is a part of the investigation. Poplin attended then President Donald Trump's Stop the Steal rally earlier that day near the White House on the Ellipse. He joined the mob of supporters who gathered at the Capitol, where lawmakers again were counting votes, counting those electoral votes coming in from states across the nation. On the Capitol's Lower West Plaza, many of you have probably have been right there. Poplin, according to the allegations in the charges against him, carried an area closed sign in his left hand and a flagpole bearing a blue flag in his right hand. A video actually captured him repeatedly striking a Metropolitan Police Department officer with the flagpole. He was arrested on a complaint charging with five counts, including felony charges of interfering with the police during a civil disorder, and yes, assaulting and resisting and impeding police with a dangerous weapon, plainly that flagpole. Nearly 1,500 people have been charged with these kinds of Capitol-related federal crimes. Many rioters were military veterans, but only a handful, like Poplin, were on active duty. He was among them. And approximately 140 police officers, as we know, were injured in that attack. Several of them have lost their lives, as did other individuals on that attack on our nation, on our Capitol on January 6th. Just this past week, Alexander Poplin, the latest defendant to be charged by the federal government while he is serving in our United States military, certainly will be discharged promptly. We always hasten to add that he is presumed innocent until proven guilty. Compelling evidence, however, finding, obviously, under this criminal complaint, almost certainly to be indicted now by a grand jury, finding probable cause to believe that he committed that offense conduct, continuing to monitor that prosecution, in addition to all the others, whether they're subject to Fisher or not, other statutes brought forward by the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia, by the Department of Justice, in an attempt to address the violent criminal behaviors of people on January 6th, not only to deter them in the future, perhaps including as soon as November, about 50 days from now, and times after that, regardless of what the result of the election may be, deterring them individually, but also deterring other people, as we have often spoke on this broadcast. That's general deterrence, sending messages that if you engage in this kind of behavior, if you engage in violent behavior, you can speak out. You've got a First Amendment right to oppose various policies and principles of the government. You can speak out in opposition to candidates, in favor of others. That is your right. You can protest, but you cannot be violent about it. That's the line. That's the line that is drawn by our Supreme Court, by our courts in understanding the First Amendment. And you cannot. You cannot engage in violence. You cannot incite violence as a part of your First Amendment expression. Mr. Poplin obviously engaging in violent behavior, nowhere near any First Amendment protections, and now facing some serious prison time if indeed he is convicted. That's the general deterrence that should come, the messaging sent to all Americans about what happens if you engage in this behavior in the future, in the immediate present, as we look forward to the election in November and matters, events, developments that happen after that. Hopefully all peaceable. Hopefully all articulating on behalf of all kinds of people, favorable results, unfavorable results, depending upon your views of the election results, but not violent behaviors. That is not a part of the First Amendment. That is not a part of our Constitution. And you will be charged and you'll be found guilty in a court of law for doing that kind of thing. As Amicus Law Review continues, we'll talk about two other matters in the federal and state courts this past week, including things in Georgia and in Cook County of just this past week involving Donald Trump, a candidate for the presidency of the United States.
This is the Shaw WAUK. It's our Fox River Day is on September 21st. Enjoy special events to celebrate, protect, and restore the health of the Fox River, including shoreline yoga, a flower blessing ceremony, art and music making, a kayak workshop, and then enjoy dancing, eating, socializing, and of course, beer at the Oktoberfest event starting at noon. You can also participate in Das Bags tournament, watch a blacksmith demonstration, or watch the Mass Krugstemmenstein holding competition. For more information and tickets, visit friendsofthefoxriver.org.
Sometimes life's challenges leave you feeling alone. We all need someone who understands and listens without judgment. That's what the 988 Wisconsin Lifeline is for. 988 is free and confidential. Trained counselors are ready to listen and provide support 24/7 for mental health and substance use concerns. You can contact 988 for yourself or for someone you know. Don't wait. Call or text 988 or chat online at 988wisconsin.org. 988 24/7. Call, text, chat. Here to support you.
Brought to you by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
This is Amicus, the Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. In the last segment of our first hour here on our weekend broadcast, talking again about Donald Trump. Why? Because he is much in the news, not only for his campaign, but also in the courts of America. We know that he is charged with criminal conduct in three cases. He has been convicted in a fourth case, that coming out of New York. Sentencing scheduled now by Juan Merchan for late November in that case. Three others pending against him, again, presumed innocent until proven guilty in those other cases, including this case, this omnibus RICO case, this RICO violation case, still pending in Fulton County, Georgia, alleging violations of state law by him and many others for attempting to subvert the voter preference in the state of Georgia. That case being handled by Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee. He's the trial judge who's presiding over that matter. You may recall, well, lots and lots of fireworks, if you will, in that courtroom when allegations were made that Fannie Willis, the prosecutor, should no longer be able to prosecute the case because of her romantic private relationship with one of her colleagues, her deputy, candidly, in the prosecution of that case. In the end, after hearings and motions and briefings by the parties, Scott McAfee determining that Fannie Willis did not engage in conduct that presented a true conflict of interest under ethics laws or under Georgia law, but did have an appearance of impropriety. And so as a result of that, that companion, that colleague inside the prosecution team, he resigned, and Fannie Willis continues to prosecute the case. But that decision went up to the appellate court there in Georgia, and that's where it's pending right now, an attack on Judge Scott McAfee's decision by the defense, saying, no, he should have thrown out the case entirely at a minimum, and should have compelled Fannie Willis to remove herself from that case. That's what's up on appeal right now. In addition, just this past week, Scott McAfee, not dealing with things, obviously, on appeal because he no longer has jurisdiction as to those, but still working on other things related to the underlying case, including many of the remaining charges of the indictments against Donald Trump and many, many others. Just this past week, Scott McAfee getting a lot of attention for dismissing three more charges in those Georgia election indictments in the interference case there against Donald Trump and other people. Specifically, Scott McAfee, in a separate ruling, determines that the bedrock charge in the indictment, racketeering, that remains in place. That doesn't change at all. But there are three dismissed counts. There are 14, 15, and 27. All of them have to do with filing false documents in a federal court. And Donald Trump is charged with two of those three counts. The judge basically invoking, believe it or not, an 1890s case that talks about the interests of the state prosecution and the federal prosecution, said these things that are alleged in counts 14 and 15 and 27, those all have to do with federal matters, false documents in federal court. One of those has to do with statements made by Donald Trump and John Eastman in a federal court, for example. And Scott McAfee finding that those things are not properly within the purview of a state court. Those are federal interests. So he dismisses those counts based upon the supremacy clause of the United States Constitution, federal law being supreme to state court, state law yielding to federal law when the two are conflicting, invoking again supremacy clause, an 1890s case that arguably supports that same result. You may recall well that McAfee previously dismissed six other counts in the indictment. 32 felony counts still remain in the wake of all of this. Those six other counts were premised upon Scott McAfee's finding that they were badly drafted, whether by the grand jury, most likely by Fannie Willis and her staff. Have to provide the defendants with more information in the charging document itself about the basis for those charges. And he said, as long as that information is not provided in that charging document, there's a due process problem. You're not telling the defendants exactly what they did. And because of that, again, Scott McAfee, way back in March, dismissed six other counts in the indictment. Those remain also on appeal, that decision by Fannie Willis, being appealed by Fannie Willis from Scott McAfee. And so altogether now he has dismissed nine counts, but Donald Trump will still face eight felony counts, down from 13 in the original indictment, and many other defendants, again, also continuing to face charges under that sweeping RICO charge, that RICO indictment. The Georgia Court of Appeals is going to hear oral arguments in December to consider whether Willis remain on the case, perhaps some of these other issues related to the legitimacy of these counts now being dismissed by Scott McAfee, affecting the prosecution, but certainly not stymieing it in any material way. The major cases, the major charges remain intact, but significant once again that Scott McAfee continuing to work on the progress of that case, even though there's no trial date. We'll presumably hear from the appellate court there in Georgia sometime in 2025, maybe returning this to the trial court and Scott McAfee for further proceedings, depending upon what it does with the particular case, including the status of the prosecutor herself, Fannie Willis. Interesting things going on there in Georgia, even as these other cases continue to move apace, slowly but surely nonetheless. And then we also have another interesting case coming out of Northern Illinois, just to the south of us here in Wisconsin, affecting, frankly, all of us, however, in the United States of America, especially those people in Cook County and people in downtown Chicago. In just this past week, a major opinion issued by a Cook County judge ruling that the Trump International Hotel and Tower, located right there on the river, on the Chicago River, right downtown in the loop area there, just across the river, violated the Illinois Environmental Protection Act. Way back in 2018, Friends of the Chicago River and others had sued, alleging that the operation of the Trump Tower, with respect to cooling water, its intake and permitting violations, had happened during a routine permit review there. Trump Tower ignored and violated federal and state laws and regulations that require buildings using systems like Trump Towers to be designed to minimize impacts on aquatic life, secure permits, operate with protective measures that are required under the law. All of that, according to the allegations and the findings now by a judge, that the Trump Tower had failed to abide by the requirements of the Illinois state law. By failing to follow permit requirements, thousands of fish and other aquatic organisms died after being sucked into the building's cooling system, according to the findings of the judge, by the intake structure actually trapped against its screens. The decision by Judge Wilson, Judge Thaddeus Wilson, found that Trump committed a continuing public nuisance through a series of failures to comply with state and federal law dating back to 2008. That, again, a civil case coming out of the Cook County Court just this past week in Illinois and in these United States of America. Amicus, a law review, continues in the next hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
The Shaw, WAUK. Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome entertainment critic and CityCast Madison newsletter editor Rob Thomas. And tis the season, so we'll talk about our favorite political movies.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8.
get ready to go for the green or gold with Civic Media's new Text to Win contest. When you go for the green or gold, you could win $100 cash, gold jewelry, and be entered to win our grand prize, two indoor club-level seats to see the green and gold in Green Bay. Download the free Civic Media app and get ready to text in for your first chance to win in this statewide contest starting Monday, September 16th. Get ready to go for the greener gold with your local Civic Media radio station. This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us. You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.